Back with you, ladies and gentlemen, at 7 minutes after the hour of 5 o'clock in America's favorite city. You're listening to WURD AM 900, your station for information, inspiration, and every once in a while, a little careful correction and I said that already, so let's get right to the conversation here. Coming to the city of Philadelphia, your fair city, in just a couple of days, actually a couple of weeks might be better off, on the 22nd, Friday, will be a town hall meeting that is entitled State of the Emergency in Black Philadelphia, Time to Heal Black Families and Communities. One of the leading voices and one of the leading forces moving this town hall meeting forward is a voice that you heard here before, who happens to be the leader of the, well, I guess the best way to put it, he happens to be the leading voice of, and I've just misplaced my notes, here it is, the leading voice of the Institute for, I don't know what I would do without you, sir, the Institute for Blacks here in our nation, and why I can't get these things straight, I am not exactly sure, but the best way to do it is to introduce our guest and let him tell you more about it himself, Dr. Ron Daniels, who's been with us previously and will be with us on the 22nd. Dr. Daniels, you're a busy man these days, sir. Welcome to the program.
I am, and by the way, I'm an occasional guest host, so I can be sympathetic, but you get your notes all mixed up.
I had it, I printed all this out, looked at it,
I said,
what happened to my brain just now?
Yeah, I know. It happens to be, when I'm doing these things as well. But let me just say, it is such a pleasure to be back with you. I enjoyed so much the interviews that we had last year, in particular right after the State of the Black World Conference. And we are repeating the theme, because the theme of the State of the Black World Conference was State of Emergency in Black America in general, Time to Heal Black Families and Communities. And we were discussing what we were going to do, how we were going to follow up. And I indicated to you at that time that we don't have the capacity, IBW, and it is the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, to do the State of the Black World Conference every year. It's such a big undertaking. But what we decided to do is to select a city per year. And maybe as we grow, we can do two cities. But certainly we were going to do one within the 12 months after the State of the Black World Conference. And I told you it was a good possibility that we'd be coming to Philadelphia. And we're on our way to Philadelphia for this town hall meeting. And it's a local and national meeting, because we're going to webcast it and all that good stuff. And by the way, we're also delighted that WURD is the media partner for this and is helping to promote it and build it. And I can't think of a better media partner than WURD, particularly on its 10th anniversary, as it celebrates its 10th anniversary.
Absolutely. Please, Dr. Daniels, continue.
Yeah, so it's not that Philadelphia is unique in terms of the state of emergency. We think there's a state of emergency in America's dark ghettos all across the country. So we could have this town hall meeting in New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Baltimore, any number of cities, because some of the conditions are the same. You know, we run into questions of underdevelopment, economic underdevelopment, the poor performing schools, the whole issue of neglect by particularly the federal government, drugs, crime, violence, fratricide, mass incarceration. These are issues that plague our communities. And so what we want to do is to take this town hall meeting, which is being done really at the suggestion of some of the leading Black professional organizations, the African-centered professional organizations locally, the Alliance of Black Social Workers, the Black Psychologists of America, and a number of other organizations, the Blacks in Criminal Justice. They're the ones who said, look, we want to become more involved in being a part of the solution. Not that they're not already doing good work, they are, because there was a conference held last year at the Alliance of Black Social Workers and Blacks in Criminal Justice pulled off. But they say we want to broaden the base and then try to figure out a way to have a much more effective interrelationship and active engagement with the grassroots community organizations, those that are doing criminal justice and drug policy reform, people who are just working out there trying to save our communities. And so this town hall meeting is a segue to really a conference, a larger conference in March. So this is a sort of a catalyst, if you will. And we were asked to try to identify national speakers who could come. Tom and offer some suggestions. And we're delighted that Dr. Mark Lamont Hill is the son of Philadelphia, really.
He is indeed.
Oh, man, and he's a rising star. Man,
he really is. And you've got some other luminary Philadelphians there, Bilal Qayyum. Chad Lasseter will be
the whole cast is. But we see that the local committee picked the local people. We were asked to pick the national people. So we got Susan L. Taylor coming. Everybody knows Susan.
Absolutely.
The National Cares Mentoring Movement, but also former editorial director of Essence Magazine. Dr. Julianne Malvo, who is one of our, if not our leading black political economists, and the former president of Bennett College for Women, and George Frazier, who came to fame with a book, maybe 25 years ago.
Race, Success Runs in Our Race. Yeah.
He is Mr. Networker. And then when you combine that with Brother Bilal and Chad Lasseter and Shondell Revell and Dorothy Johnson Spate, I mean, this is like a must-come-to event. And let me just say the other thing I'm excited about. It's always hard to find venues, so we searched here and we searched there. And we finally were able to, settle on Resurrection Community Methodist Church. And we were there last week, actually. And I got to say, the welcome that we received by Reverend Dr. Michael Tyson, the pastor there, and the chairman of the trustee board, they are so excited about this.
I can imagine. Now, for those of you who are not aware of where Resurrection Community Methodist Church is, we're going to be plying you with their address on a regular basis. They're located at 6200 Dix Avenue in Southwest Philadelphia. We'll be telling you how to get there and exactly where that is. And for those of you who may not know the southwest portion of Philadelphia as well, how many folks are we expecting at this event? Because I'm beginning to think that that the numbers are going to swell as more information gets out.
Well, we want to pack the house, and I don't know what those numbers will look like. I think the church holds maybe about 500 people or so, and we'd like to have them hanging out of the rafters.
Yeah.
So one of the things that the church members indicated is that they felt this would be good not only for the entire city of Philadelphia, but for that particular community. So they're going to make a special outreach to community-based organizations in that area, to the elected officials in that area, to have them become involved as well. Because, it's obviously we have meetings, we have conferences, we have big events all the time. But I think we're in a period, Nick, where we can't meet enough. I mean, I think we're in such crises as black people in this country that we really do need to be in continual conversation. And not only in conversation for conversation's sake, but finding ways and means in which we can intensify and strengthen the bonds of collaboration. That's what IBW, the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, tries to promote. We're doing that kind of work in Pittsburgh with the Justice Collaborative there, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., those three cities intensely doing work in those three cities. We bring together in each of those cities anywhere from 15 to 25 organizations who meet with each other every 3 months just to share information. Because what happens is, even though we're in the same city doing exactly the same work, we have multiple organizations who really don't on a regular basis communicate with each other.
That's true.
We can't afford that.
Yeah, you got to have a nexus, and I believe that the Institute of the Black World will provide that nexus. Let me ask you a question, Dr. Daniels, because people who looked at the poster, they said, is it really an emergency? Help people to shape this up in their own minds. Why are we using the term emergency? Are we blowing the whistle or pushing the panic button, or is it really an emergency? And if so, explain this for folks.
Well, we think it's a state of emergency, and we take blame if people feel that that's not an appropriate term. And if you live in the suburbs or the outer burbs, it's probably not a state of emergency. But if you live in the urban inner city areas where the unemployment rate, I don't live in Philadelphia, I can bet without even being there that the unemployment rate among young black men under the ages of 30 is at least 30%.
It's a little over 30% last we checked.
Yeah, I don't even have to, what I'm saying? But this is not just Philadelphia, it's everywhere. Now, I defy you to tell me if white people had that kind of stuff, a level of unemployment, they would be in the streets. There would be open warfare in America. But then I know, every week almost, in every city across this country in the urban inner city areas, some mother and father are weeping over the death of their child because of the violence and the fratricide that's going on in our communities. I mean, there's a tremendous, what I call a combustible cauldron of dysfunction, which is fueled by, I think the first thing it's fueled by is the utter level of joblessness in our community. We don't have jobs. We don't have sufficient economic development. Now, it's not that we can necessarily cure all that locally, but we can begin to put our minds to that more sufficiently. The second thing is a cultural question. It's a question of, you know, us believing in ourselves as people, particularly among young folk who are out there who are engaged. And just interesting discussion today around this whole the guy who bullied so-called the...
Oh, right. Incognito.
Incognito. But one of the things that came out was the degree to which he was allowed in the locker room to use the N-word. I mean, he was just like, and the black players were, oh, it's okay. I mean, we have Kanye West going out here now selling merchandise with the Confederate flag on it.
It's not
okay. I mean, there's a cultural piece here that we've got to reemphasize in terms of who we are as black people, as people of African descent. And we're not saying that because we want to be opposed to anybody else. But if we can't affirm, and we got into this whole thing now where we're of color. I mean, it's like, I thought we put away the color people thing like 50 years ago.
Hmm.
And it's interesting how we've kind of slid away from a specificity of our sense of identity. And let me just say, I work with Latinos, I work with Asians, I work with Native Americans, I work with progressive white people, I work with everybody. But charity begins at home and spreads abroad. We have to be about the business of organizing ourselves more rigorously and vigorously around our own resources, our own sense of our own identity. I mean, a station like Word, I mean, that's one of the reasons it exists. And no doubt struggles to some degree because we don't have black people who will, in fact, put pressure on advertisers who are not sufficiently willing to invest in our community. You know, I mean, and that's for black radio, black newspapers, black media across the board suffers because, you know, and we don't have the kind of aggressive fighting spirit. So there is a state of emergency, and that state of emergency has to do with a crisis in our sense of who we are as a people, a crisis in our mentality, but it's also a crisis objectively in terms of the fact that there's joblessness, there's crime, there's violence, there's fratricide, and it's pain, there's tremendous pain in our community. And so we don't come, these organizations don't come saying we are going to solve it. We talk about, quote, additional solutions. People are already doing excellent work in Philadelphia and all the other cities. It's just a matter of, can we exchange more information with each other? Can we collaborate just a little bit more in terms of exchanging information and figuring out how collectively we can be more effectively than we are currently being?
We're speaking with Dr. Ron Daniels, who is the president of the Institute of the Black World, and he'll be in town on the 22nd, along with quite a few others who have a lot to add to the dialogue at a conference that is entitled State of the Emergency in Black Philadelphia. And from what Dr. Daniels just told us, one of the real emergency issues is that so many people can't sense the emergency. We'll come back and continue this conversation with Dr. Daniels and with you, opening up the phone lines right after we take our next traffic break and have a few messages. Stay with us, folks. You're listening to WURD AM 900. This is the Nick Taliaferro Show. All right, good people, 24 minutes after the hour, 5 o'clock, here on America's favorite station in America's favorite city. At least we like to think that way. This is the Nick Taliaferro Show, and we're glad that you can join us. Our guest on our news line today is Dr. Ron Daniels, who happens to be the director of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. I bet you if I really look at my notes and practice, I can get this stuff right.
Sure you're right.
Dr. Daniels is talking to us about an upcoming conference, a symposium, a forum that will be held here in the city of Philadelphia on the 22nd, entitled State of the Emergency in Black Philadelphia, Time to Heal Black Families and Communities. There's a glowing list of individuals who will be a part of this forum, but most importantly, you can be a part of it. If I'm correct, Dr. Daniels, we are opening this to the public. Do people have to register?
No, it's free and open to the public. IBW never charges for educational forums. There are costs associated with them, but we do it the old-fashioned way. We say to people, free and open to the public, but tax-deductible contributions will be welcome. We will make an appeal at the event.
Gotcha.
But we don't want anybody not to be able to come because they don't have resources. And by the way, WURD is going to broadcast the town hall meeting live. So that's the other great benefit that's going to be presented. And by the way, people can already, you know, they can go to our website, IBW21.org. That's www.IBW21.org. In order to get information, if you haven't seen the flyer, you'll be able to see it. And there is a information, a local information number, 215-226-4835. That's 215-226-4835. As the word spreads, and we have really a great gathering, a coming together, if you will. It's going to be inspirational, just like you talked about the word, inspirational, informational, and hopefully what will come out of it is a pathway towards action, because we want to, it's good for us to fellowship and good for us to be together, but at the end of the day, we really are going to be building towards a March conference, a two-day conference, and we'll be giving more details about that, in which we really follow up and embrace each other as black people, share information with each other as black people, learn from each other as we fight our way out of this state of emergency. Because it has to be settled at several levels. Number one, we ask the question, what can we do for ourselves? What can we do for ourselves? Then secondly is, what are we asking private sector institutions that benefit from our dollars? We're getting ready to do Black Friday. Has been moved up beyond Black Friday.
Now it's Black Thanksgiving.
Black Friday. They want your money right now. But what are we demanding in exchange for our patronage? You see, I mean, we have almost $1 trillion in our hands, and we go to places, we give up our dollars, we don't demand anything, we don't punish those who don't support us, and we've got to get back into a kind of resistance attitude, a mode of organizing, of fighting for freedom in a way that we haven't perhaps as strongly as we should have been. And then finally, what do we expect of government, both local and state, but equally important now, the federal government? I mean, I love our president. I think it's, you know, he's had some major, major challenges. But one of the things that has not been sufficiently on the agenda is the question of economic development and jobs for the urban inner city. It has not been prioritized. He's not come out to say, well, wait a minute, there are people in these urban inner city areas that are catching more hell than ever before. This is a state of emergency. We need our federal government to speak out on it. We actually need our president to speak out on it and draw attention to the fact that there's so much suffering. And he has. I mean, there's been stuff in Chicago and various other places. But it's almost been almost like, well, if you just behave better, if you just, you know, dress up better, yeah. You just, you know, I mean, and we know about that, and we preach that, and we believe that to be true. But a job with good wages and good benefits wouldn't hurt.
You know, for those who are listening, one of the things I just want to say at the right here at the front before we even have the conference, one of the things I appreciate you about you, Dr. Daniels, is your positive, proactive, and fair approach to addressing these issues. And I sense that this forum is going to be very similar to that. This isn't simply a gripe fest where people will come and stick their fist in the air and harangue about the problems that exist, but this is one of those kind of sessions where people will be sharing more light than simply heat, talking about solutions and sharing different cures and different ideas that have been manifested in different places. Am I right in reading it that way?
You're absolutely right, because when you look at the all of the people who are local presenters, I know Dorothy Johnson Spate, you know, Mothers in Charge, I mean, working on issues of mass incarceration, with Brother Bilal, certainly not only locally, he has a national reputation, I mean, in terms of not only the Father's Day rally, but I know he has been working with other organizations.
The Black Values Movement is one of them.
Right. Yeah, absolutely trying to do this work. And so, again, you know, we're just so honored to be able to. So, yeah, he's not coming. He's coming sharing ideas. And then you look at the kind of work that Mark Lamont Hill is doing, staying true to his roots, staying true to who he is as a black man, if you will, brilliant, capable, able, trained right there and educated right there at Temple University. But he represents. Susan Taylor has a national mentoring cares movement. I mean, she has devoted her life now to mentoring, you know, thousands upon thousands of young black people all across this country. Dr. Julianne Malvo, you know, former president of Bennett College for Women, she took that on with a passion. I mean, I have the stories of her helping to educate people. I mean, working with the families. And she is just aggressively always out here trying to educate us about the political economy of our community, what the fallacies and faults are in relation to public policy, how we need to address those things. And, of course, George Frazier, you know, he's dedicated to the whole question of producing wealth that can be passed on intergenerationally and making black people the number one employees of black people in the 21st century. He has been dedicated to that cause, and he is selfless. He is hardworking. So these are the kind of people that we're bringing to the table for this conversation on November 22nd at the Resurrection Community Methodist Church in Southwest Philadelphia.
We'll keep that address in front of people so that folks can know the date and the address of the event. For those of you who might wish to join this conversation, let me give you the phone number here. It's WRD studio number. It's 215-634-8065. That is 215-634-8065. One more time, 215-634-8065. For those listening in outlying areas who wish to make a toll-free call, you can get in touch with us here by dialing 866-361-0900. That is 866-361-0900. You give us a call, we'll put you on, and you can become a part of this conversation that we're having with Dr. Ron Daniels from the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, the organization that is spearheading this upcoming, this gathering of like-minded souls as we discuss the state of emergency that exists in Black Philadelphia and all around the country, actually. It's entitled Time to Heal Black Families and Communities. Dr. Daniels, I wanted to take just I want to drill down a little bit and look at the concept of time to heal black families. A lot of people are steering away from the idea of even talking about families because they want to avoid the discussion that might come about marriage and all of that kind of thing, thinking that perhaps the idea of family is something that only right-wing conservatives talk about. But when we talk about healing black families, what issues in particular might we be addressing?
Well, you know, that's interesting. I don't know how many people went to see the movie 12 Years a Slave, but it just reminded us, and then I saw an episode last night of Skip Gates' piece. I have some issues part of what he has to do.
Yeah.
But certainly the episode I saw last night talking about emancipation and Reconstruction. I mean, the way in which black people have fought over the years to try to keep families together. I mean, against the odds, trying to find ways and means of keeping our families together is incredibly important. But let me just say this. Family, it seems to me, has to be defined several different ways. Number one, yes. I mean, it's great if you can have mother and father, you know, in the home together. That is family. But, you know, in our history, we've always had an extended family in several ways. Number one, you know, if there's a single parent, then we have a collective responsibility to still support that mother or father who is a single parent to help raise the children collectively. That is the village concept that we need to drill into our consciousness. And then beyond that, there is the extended family, the extended biological family of auntie and grandma and grandpa and whatever. But then the real deal is the whole notion of no motherless children, no fatherless children. That is to say that the children of black people are our collective avocation. They belong to us, and we have to share with them. And I tell you why that's important. Because, you know, in the whole crisis now, we have so many people who may be living not only in poverty, but people who are, there are lots of single family homes. Not necessarily always by choice, but because, you know, the father may be in the criminal justice system. Or mother may be as well. And so we have to be able to support those families in whatever way we can. Some people are alcohol addicted. Some people are drug addicted. Some people are struggling with mental illnesses. What are we to say? Do we expect the same thing from those families that we expect from so-called stable middle-class families? Or do we supplement those families by looking at what happens in community centers, what happens in churches, what happens with organizations like the Alliance of Black Social Workers and Psychologists, and administrators in black family welfare who can be available to aid and assist families to, in fact, overcome both mental issues as well as to be available to talk about how to overcome economic issues and social issues in our community as well. So it's really about how do we, first of all, not get stuck on the family as just a mother and father, though I'm saying that's obviously desirable and preferable, but But a family is a family. So a mother who has children is, is a family. So is a father who raising children is a family. Then how do we support the different varieties of families that exist in our community such that we can raise children in a healthy environment? And that means that we have to then look at all the other issues that are related to that. I think that has to do with schools. And in fact, you know, people are beginning to catch up, I say, because one of the things that happens sometimes, I'm not able to write as much as I want to. Many years ago in Omaha, Nebraska, I put forth a concept about the schools being a very central place, particularly in urban inner city areas where you have so much issues of unemployment, and all that. The school has to be like, it has to have everything. It has to have counselors. It has to have people.
It's an omnibus.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
I get you.
It has to be that place where it becomes almost a surrogate for the family, in the sense that you can get counseling there, both occupational counseling. You can get psychological counseling if you want. You can get academic counseling if you want. But also referrals in terms of jobs. There are social workers there. I mean, that's my ideal model of a school, because, you know, what you hear in a lot of conversations is, well, it really starts with the family. And what they really mean is they have this idea in their head of a stable, middle-class class black family, mother and father. But suppose you don't have that.
Suppose the family needs to be shored up first.
That's right.
So
you can't expect a family where the mother is an alcoholic, father is in prison. I mean, I'm not wishing this, but these are the circumstances that some of our kids grow up in.
I can't. There's a question I want to ask you in just a moment about how you feed your own spirit, because I have never heard you sound down, even as you talked about some of the most dire circumstances. I'll ask that question after we take our first caller, but I deeply enjoy these exchanges, and I can't wait until you come into Philadelphia and you're able to address us in a more whole, in a more ambient manner. Our guest is Dr. Ron Daniels. He is the director of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. There's a conference coming your way entitled The State of Emergency in Black Philadelphia, Time to Heal Black Families and Communities, on the 22nd of November. That is a Friday, starting at 7 o'clock, going until 9:30 in the evening at the Resurrection Community Methodist Church, located in Southwest Philadelphia at 6200 Dix Avenue. We'll keep that in front of you, but first, let's get to our phone calls as we continue our dialogue with Dr. Daniels. We're going now to Shafia in West Philadelphia. Shafia?
Hey,
Shafiq.
Hey,
I'm sorry, I got it all backwards there.
No problem, Nick.
I'm learning this is not my day today, Shafiq, but welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
Sure enough.
Good conversation. I wanted to ask, Just reflecting back, maybe about 7-8 years ago, I remember being at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and remember watching a presentation that the indigenous people from Russia actually used the situation with the blacks in Chicago to kind of show similarities for their struggles.
Wow.
And that got me thinking that when you look at the type of institutions that have been created to suppress people, I mean, if we were anywhere else, these would be considered crimes against humanity. So I'm trying to understand, when we do conferences like this, why don't we tackle the issue of these crimes against humanity, and, you know, take these issues on an international forum, such as like the OAS, the Organization of American States, their human rights court. They have a human rights court. Because what's being done to people, black people across this country, are crimes against humanity.
That is it's a very valid question. Let me see if we can get a response from our guest for you, Shafiq.
Well, it doesn't. I mean, first of all, if you want to talk about it in terms of human rights, we certainly support that idea. This is it's not a new idea. Certainly, Malcolm, Patterson, others have dealt with it. And in fact, organizations like the National Black United Front have taken these issues, you know, to the United Nations and have talked about particularly the issue of racism in the United States of America. There is a repertoire in the United States that deals with, I mean, within the United Nations that deals with issues of racism, and they, and there was a tour done several years ago, and the United States was indicted, at least on these issues in terms of police brutality was certainly one of the areas that was highlighted as being a big problem. But the issue of a crime against humanity has a specific definition in the international arena. So because black people are unemployed, we would argue is a violation of human rights in the sense that the UN Charter on the UN Charter deals with, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights talks about education, economic development, all those kinds of issues. And you can raise those issues, and we should raise them at the level of international platforms, and there are organizations that do that. However, we also have right in front of us a municipal government, we have a state government, and we have a federal government. And we also have access to the levers of power in terms of electoral political participation. But beyond that, we also have the ability to use other things that are within our hands, the ability to use economic sanctions, for example, to defend and project our interests, as we have been advocating around Trayvon Martin, and we're not giving up on that in terms of Florida's stand your ground laws. So it is, yes, we can appeal to international bodies. That is a useful exercise. But there are also some very specific concrete things that we can do right in front of us that we need to do better, stronger, more effectively than we're doing now. And that's not to say that people aren't doing these things. It's just a matter of how do we coalesce more, how do we come together much more effectively to get this done, to create a critical mass. Because right now what's happening is, you know, we got a lot of black people sitting on the sidelines. We got black people sitting on the sidelines until something happens to them.
Yeah. I hear you there.
And then all of a sudden they're reaching out for word. They're reaching out for the NAACP. They're reaching out for...
Right, you know. When my son is stopped and frisked and put in jail, then all of a sudden it really is an issue.
It becomes a revelation.
I get you.
You know, that racism is still alive and well in these United States of America.
So it's not either or for you. It's both and. We do this and we do the other. And there are others who are doing that larger picture, that grander scale of going to the international courts and so forth. Shafiq, I appreciate that question. Let's continue on with our dialogue with Dr. Ron Daniels by taking our next call. Dave in Northern Liberties, thank you for your call and welcome to the conversation.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure enough.
It's a pleasure talking to both of you. Dr. Daniels, it's a very great honor talking to you, sir.
Well, thank you.
I'm glad that you put this together, and I hope to hear more from you. I'm 70 years old. I use a walker for the past 5 years to get around, but I get around to just about every, you know, thing that I think is important. It's important to me. And, you know, I hope it's important to these people who decided whether to let somebody else take their life in their hands by voting for them in their place yesterday. They've taken all our schools away from us. We used to have the polling places in there where parents had dignity to walk to the polls with their children, check the school out, and vote. But they've taken all this stuff away from them, put it, changed redistricting, everything done all over the country for people, you know, to be displaced on voting election day. None of our major stations even let us know in Pennsylvania that we were, it was our obligation and job to vote. But, you know, now it seems like we're voting in a back alley. Yeah. This is not just happening in Philly. Thank you for coming to Philadelphia. I will be there if I have to crawl just like I did yesterday to vote. Thank you.
Well, Dave, we hope that you don't have to crawl. And maybe what we need to do is put the word out to some of our leading congregations and churches around so that if people need a ride, some of our churches can help to bring people to this gathering.
That would be great. And let me just comment on, and that's another aspect, and when you see this assault on black people, and it's interesting how the assault is taking place at the time when we have a black family in the White House. I mean, this is it's not an irony, it's a contradiction in some ways. Because on the one hand, America clearly, there are sufficient numbers of Euro-ethnics or white people in America who were willing to vote for President Barack Obama that he's in the White House. I mean, we could not have elected President Obama just by black or Latino, Asian, and Native American votes alone. We needed a significant number of whites to do that. That would not have happened 50 years ago. Impossible. It just would not have happened. So It did happen. But at the same time, what do we find happening? You know, the number of militias in the country increased dramatically. Sale of guns go through the roof because this whole notion of two things.
Yeah.
Legitimately, some people are fearful that the Second Amendment may be eroded, but other people are fearful of black people. I mean, that's the Trayvon Martin story. Here is the perception of the dangerous black man that's been created and propagated all across the screens and Stop and Frisk and all of these people who are going to, the horde of black people and people of color who are coming to take our country has become a part of what is a part of the difficulty as well, with a stubborn minority of white people. And I use my words advisedly because I don't indict all white people in that regard.
Right.
I think, obviously, racism is a problem for many of them, but the most virulent is the stubborn resistance. And a part of that is the stripping of our vote, the effort to do all kinds of things, these voter suppression rules, these voter ID things that on the surface sound just wonderful, but there is no fraud. I mean, this is like a policy looking in certain...
A solution looking for a problem, yeah.
Problem the other way around.
Yeah.
And in Florida, I think what Congresswoman Corrine Brown pointed out in Jacksonville, that it took the voting place out of the inner city where it was accessible and put it literally out about 7 or 8 miles out in the field somewhere. I mean, this is just right in your face saying, look, black folks, we're coming for you. Now, what we have to do is to say, okay, you coming for us? You put it in the field? You know, we've been through this before. This ain't the first time in our history we've faced barriers like this. If you put it in the field, you try to stop us from voting, we're going into the field because you're not turning us back.
Right.
That's the kind of spirit that we have to have, and we got to imbue in our, particularly our young people, some of whom have given up or who don't even have a sense of we need a movement. We need to help spark that movement and help engage them in this process, because I do declare, to the degree that they are engaged and have a sense of this kind of cultural, political resistance, the kind of death and destruction in our community will go down. Let me just make this last point. When the Million Man March convened, it was notable that for that 24-hour, 48-hour period all across the country, violence and fratricide went down.
I mean, that is true.
That's an objective story. Am I lying?
No, it isn't. Now, I don't know if it's anecdotal or not, but someone said that there was not one act of it nationally, and I don't know if that's true or not, but whatever it was, the numbers went down so drastically that it actually scared some people.
Yeah, and what that says is if we can create, because you know, it's hard if you don't have a job. I was talking to Susan Taylor recently. She's got a major project she's working on, trying to do work in Chicago. But she said at the end of the day, Ron, you know, she said the thing we're not being able to answer is once we get people up to the point of saying, well, wait, we shouldn't do this, we don't want to do this, then we got to be able to provide jobs. We can, in fact, get X numbers of people in the community to stop the violence and destruction just on the basis of just beginning to create a sense of we care about ourselves, the spirit of resistance of who we are, and whatever. But then that has to be translated into getting people engaged in a struggle. And it is a monumental struggle today, because there's a fight for the very heart and soul of this country today. When you see the Tea Party, these Tea Party reactionaries, and dare I say some of them are outright racist, and you know, it's like, you know, they're no longer as Jesse Jackson used to say, they're no longer in the white sheets. They're in the blue suits and the black coats.
Absolutely, yeah.
But couched behind that is a fear, opposition, and even to some people, not hatred of black people, and this whole notion that the browning of America, and they want to stop it. And as a result of that, you know, they are in fact obstructing President Obama's agenda at many levels.
I want to interrupt you right now to ask you the question that I had broached a little bit earlier, Dr. Daniels, and that is, you know, in all of the times that I've spoken with you, your spirit and your enthusiasm has always been on the upswing, always on the upward incline. What is it that keeps you ebullient and hopeful in the face of some of the dastardly and dire things that you have seen? What feeds your spirit? And I'm asking this question from, you know, just another man asking a good man, what keeps you going this way?
Well, it's a matter of, and when I'm also a teacher, and I teach this to my students, And when I teach, when I try to teach leadership and I try to teach organizing, I try to give people a sense of where we've been. If we understand where we've been as a people, if we understand, it's like Malcolm said, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. If we understand the tremendous difficulties that we have gone through, the trials and tribulations as a race, and yet in spite of that, as Maya Angelou says, still we rise. I mean, we've had our setbacks, but somehow, in spite of all these adversities, we've managed to survive. We've managed to continue. Maybe you push forward, you get pushed back some, but you keep coming. You keep coming. And if we understand the nature of what happened to us, even in a city like Philadelphia, where Du Bois wrote the book, what, Philadelphia Negro, right?
Right. He
wrote this book to talk about the fact that we once controlled so many different industries, so many different areas, whether it was as caterers and tailors and whatever, and how we got pushed out of these areas. So today we look at it and we can indict ourselves, oh, black people won't do it. But we did do that at one point. But because of white supremacy, we got pushed out of it. And so when I look back on our history and look back on what we've come through, and that we have managed to overcome these things, then even though I see, you know, defeat and I see, you know, despair, then because I know what has happened to us, then I don't get driven down into despair because I understand. I understand why we are how we are, and that the only way to solve that really is to continue to remain optimistic, is to continue to do the work, to continue to push. And then it's my own history, man. I mean, I came out of the Hill District of Pittsburgh, you know, and with my mother and, you know, my father divorced, and, you know, but the institutions in the community, you know, who came and wrapped themselves around me, and then me making a commitment, you know, because of the trials and tribulations of my mother who suffered and, you know, had a nervous breakdown trying to raise her kids in this environment. I said, look, you know, I got to do something. I could go either way. I could have gone one way in terms of despair and destruction, but I've decided then to devote my life, you know, to try to make it better for black people.
Was this something, I mean, and this is just, now I ask you a question about your own education and how you were trained. Some people have these things drilled into them from the earliest time. They don't remember not thinking that way. Or did you have to discover did you come to this conclusion that, hey, as a people, we have faced these things and we've overcome them? Or were these facts drilled into your mind, these teachings, were they given to you as a child, or did you learn them and develop them until you reached an apotheosis that said, hey, we just keep coming? Which one was it?
Well, it's a combination of both. Part of it I would not have recognized as it being drilled into me. And I say that because it was my father as a griot, you know, born in Georgia.
Okay.
And we went for, I don't know, 13, 14 years straight out of Youngstown, Ohio, then to Georgia, now to Atlanta and just below Atlanta, Georgia. And then down to his homestead. We took that trip every year for 13, 14 years.
Wow.
But it was interesting, and I wrote about this later, because he would pack up his Smith & Wesson, his Blue Steel Smith & Wesson, and tuck it up under the seat. And then we would go by way of Covington, Kentucky. The world changed, and I remember vividly how the world changed and how my father, as a man now, had to go and ask people, do you serve black people here? And then, you know, all through, but also remembering, you know, you had black sessions, black restaurants and so forth in Nashville and these different places. And then going into the South and seeing, you know, black churches and black institutions that were there, you know, in the South as well. But beyond that, you know, my father taking us to a place and showing us where one of our family members was lynched. And then he was himself always somebody who was a profound believer in the NAACP, you know. And he talked about Tuskegee Institute and what that meant to black people. That's the Booker T. Washington part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I didn't realize then, I mean, he probably didn't either. But later on in my life, these kinds of stories of the trials and tribulations and the struggles of black people. And then going, you know, to these churches and having homecoming and hear them black folks sing them hymns, man, them call and response songs. Man.
Yeah,
you know? And you can almost hear, you can hear the echoes of slavery in the back, in your mind. But people, again, you know, struggling and surviving. And then on my mother's side, you know, as a brilliant woman, you know, who coming up through the Great Depression in West Virginia, because I'm a son of a coal miner and a coal miner's daughter. My mother you know, coming out of the cold.
You can almost make a country song out of that one.
She talked to him. She would tell us about the Great Depression, man, and how rough it was and how difficult it was in the Great Depression, and drilled into our consciousness, you know, the need, you know, to be self-sufficient and to learn how to take care of yourself and whatever. I mean, so we had that. And then going into Pittsburgh and experiencing both the church, Ebenezer Baptist Church, where I was baptized at 12 years old, mm-hmm. came to Philadelphia as the youngest delegate ever to come out of that state to a BYPU convention when I was a youngster.
Okay.
In Philadelphia. I can remember, you know, that kind of stuff. But then it was the Black Consciousness Movement later on. As I went to college and I began to study and then, you know, learn and then look, reflect back on our history, looking at Before the Mayflower, that one book, the first 20 pages of Lerone Bennett's Before the mm-hmm. Mayflower just lifted me up and say, we are somebody. We are somebody. You know, we have a history. We have a background. And I was deeply engaged, you know, in the Black Consciousness Movement. I was at Philadelphia 1968 for the Black Power Conference. You know, I mean, so, you know, so I'm revealing also my Philadelphia connections in that regard. So these are the things that have fueled and fed me, you know, over the years. And so, yeah, it was a combination of things that I would not have been conscious of initially, but my father talking about being a griot, my mother being a griot of sorts, telling these stories. You know, when I teach my classes, you know, when we talk about the March on Washington, I can remember my mother talking about leaving the coal fields of West Virginia to go work in the Federal Mint, you know, in Washington, D.C. Well, I now know that was a direct consequence of the fact that A. Philip Randolph stood up and told Franklin Delano Roosevelt, hey, you know, you want black people to support this war? We ain't down with this. You're going to change this. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt issued a Fair Employment Practices Commission piece. That enabled my mother and black people for the first time to work in the war industries and go to the... I mean, also, so in a way, I've tied that history up, you know, and I can teach my classes out of my own history of the griot, my family, my mother, father, and my own experiences, you know, coupled with my formal training as really one of the pioneers, because we created the discipline of the black studies. We didn't know what we knew what we wanted to do with that, but we had to create a black studies department at Temple University, African Studies and Research Center at Cornell, all these different Kent State University, well, Pan-African Studies. We, all these things we as a people created.
Well, what I'd like to do, and because the time has raced by on us and we've got about 30 seconds or so left, we want to remind everybody about the upcoming event. And Dr. Daniels, you know, I want to thank you personally for your leadership and for not only the leadership, but the inspiration that you bring with that leadership that encourages me, and I know it encourages other people out there. It's the 22nd of November. And once again, if you would let everybody know the name of the church, the name of the the location itself, and what other salient items they need to know to become a part of this conference.
Well, it's called State of Emergency in Black Philadelphia, and we have a stellar, you know, national and local cast. They're all important people. Resurrection Community Methodist Church, and that's at 6200 Dix Avenue in West Philadelphia. Reverend Dr. Michael T. Tyson is the pastor there. Is going to welcome us. And people can go to the website, www.ibw21.org, ibw21.org, or you can call and help, by the way, to organize people at 215-226-4835, 215-226-4835. And we look forward to, you know, again, Word will be there to broadcast it.
Absolutely.
Word is the principal media sponsor. I know they're going to be running, you know, announcements for us and everything, and we just... delighted to be associated with Word and this effort and the 10th anniversary of this great station.
Well, we've got to go, but I want to ask, what I'll do is I want to stay in touch with you so that we can talk to some of the folks in preparation for this meeting. We'll keep this in front of the people. Dr. Daniels, as always, thanks so much for your time and for your leadership.
My privilege. Really appreciate it.
All right, sir. Dr. Ron Daniels, ladies and gentlemen, the Executive Director of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. We'll take a quick pause and we'll come back in just a moment. You're listening to WURD AM 900.